Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Falstaff's Blog Talk Radio Show. I have Siggy of SigmundCarolAndAlfred.wordpress.com, and our guest this morning is Scott Sweat of ToSetTheRecordStraight.com, who has written a book titled To Set the Record Straight, How Swift Boat Veterans, POWs, and the New Media Defeated John Kerry. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, thank you for having me.
One thing, reading the book, you open the book talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong in the pronunciation, Ion Pasepa, the Romanian general who was the highest ranking Soviet general to defect to the West.
Soviet bloc general, General Pacepa, I think is how it's pronounced, was actually Romanian.
Okay. Right. And why is he so important?
Well, he provides a perspective on the war crimes propaganda campaign that was sponsored and heavily funded by the Soviet Union during the Vietnam War, even before American military involvement in the war got well underway. And he said on other occasions that he helped produce very much the same sorts of documentary evidence, forgeries, of course, that was cited by American protest groups such as John Kerry's Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So to show that this is essentially a propaganda campaign rather than an attempt to expose reality on the battlefield, we started out by showing how that propaganda campaign was initiated and how it came to the United States.
Didn't he also write on the creation of Yasser Arafat?
I believe he did. He's written several books, not all of which I've read.
Right. I think he wrote on the creation of Yasser Arafat, how he was pretty much, like you say, a front man for a whole bunch of different ideologies. The one question I want to ask you is you had in the past spoken about the atrocities that were committed in Vietnam as primarily atrocities committed by the North Vietnamese.
Yes, I think that's historically accurate.
Right, and if you could, I think listeners would, and myself more than anybody, would benefit from your assessment and explanation of that. Because you know, we're all inundated with this image of the American soldier that had committed war crimes, war atrocities, and so on and so forth. When, of course, in reality, the atrocities and war crimes committed by Americans pale in comparison to the atrocities committed by the North Vietnamese.
Well, yeah, I think that sums it up fairly accurately. The key difference is that for the North Vietnamese and for their proxies, the Viet Cong, atrocities were policy. Those who committed what we would consider war crimes against civilians in the South that weren't going along with the Viet Cong program were given medals and awards, whereas Americans who committed war crimes, and there were some, were not rewarded. They were, you know, sent to prison when their acts were discovered. So I think the fundamental difference is, and of course the same is true in Iraq, that policy of atrocities on one side and an attempt to avoid them on the other characterizes the American participation in both wars.
Right, I think that also carries on throughout the Middle East, you know, on the whole. I mean, the recent assassination by Israel, more likely, of Mugnia, is you know, and the way he was mourned as if he was some kind of hero.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and this guy, of course, was nothing but a two bit pipsqueak butcher. I mean, that's all he was.
Well, one of some technical talent, it would appear.
Yeah, one of some technical talent. Yeah.
Guys, a request from the chat room. They are requesting that we speak a little louder because it's a little too soft. The sound is a little too soft, and
okay.
I don't have a means of raising the volume myself.
Then we shall yell at Wild Phil's direction.
I'm sorry. This is one narrative of, you know, American atrocities that has been perpetuated in movies, in all sorts of media, in books, and in a great deal of fiction. And there is an attempt to make it this way in Iraq, too.
Yes, and it's being attempted by some of the same people. In fact, the Iraq Veterans Against the War are being advised by a number of former leaders of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who, more than any other group, were the architects of the war crimes propaganda campaign that we trace in the book.
See, now that's news. That's big news. What you're saying is the Iraq Veterans Against the War are effectively an offshoot of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War?
Well, it's not exactly breaking news. The Iraq veterans brag about that on their website. And if you Google the Iraq Veterans Against the War's fundraising activities, you'll run across names that are familiar to BVAW researchers, such as that of Joe Bangert, who made malignant and false claims that U.S. troops were butchering civilians on the main road into Saigon and so forth.
Right, and this is where the John Kerry story, you know, grows legs here, because he was an integral part of that organization.
Well, he gave him credibility. His role was, he was the guy that went over to Vietnam and acquired medals and then came back and could put a heroic face on what otherwise was some very unlikely and poorly backed propaganda.
Did he do it on his own, or was he instructed to do so by these organizations?
Was he instructed to do
that? In other words, was this idea, when John Kerry got up and started talking about atrocities, particularly ones that never occurred, was this John Kerry being John Kerry, or was this John Kerry as a mouthpiece or as a front for something bigger?
Oh, I think very much the latter. Kerry had already met with Madame Binh, the top political representative of the Viet Cong, a year before he gave his Senate testimony in a secret meeting in Paris. We don't know exactly what they discussed, but for a Navy lieutenant to just happen to run across somebody like that, certainly not a coincidence.
Yes. That's one thing that you emphasize in the book, that these were meetings that you cannot have just run into. These were meetings that had to be carefully arranged.
Yeah, the North Vietnamese very carefully vetted those members of the anti-war movement who they thought could be useful to them, and only permitted those to make the pilgrimage to Moscow, or in the case of Kerry, to Paris. And it appears from our research and from things that came out later in 2004 that such meetings in Paris were a large part of how the North Vietnamese directed the anti-war movement. And I don't think that's too strong a term.
We have a caller from area code 651. Hello, caller.
Hi, Faustus. Wild Phil.
Hi, Phil.
You can call me Wild Phil. That's okay. I give
Hi,
you
Wild
permission.
Phil.
Okay. I just kind of wanted to ask the guest, has he heard of the issue with John Kerry's supposedly secret CIA guy going into him and the guy going into Cambodia back in 69?
What Kerry claimed on many occasions, one of which was before the U.S. Senate, was that he had been ordered on an illegal mission into Cambodia, where he initially said that he was ordered to fight against the Khmer Rouge. And as part of the investigation that the Swiftboat Veterans for Truth and others did into Kerry's actual Vietnam activities, they took a look at that. And Kerry had claimed that on Christmas Day of 1968
that's when this
happened. And his own authorized biography by Douglas Brinkley, Tour of Duty, showed pretty clearly that he wasn't there. And the Swift Vets got a hold of a man named Stephen Gardner, who was his gunner at the time, And Gardner placed him very clearly at a place called Sadek, which was a good 50 miles from the border. Further investigation showed that the border was completely closed, that nobody could have crossed it, that they would have been arrested if they had. And the one event where somebody had actually gone across the border turned into Cambodia, turned into a fairly major international incident. Now, the following year, the U.S. invaded Cambodia, and things changed significantly in that regard. But Carey's claims appear to have been lifted directly from the movie Apocalypse Now.
That figures. The reason I brought that up, because he made a big ordeal of it, I think it was on the Boston Globe or something, about him and his secret briefcase and his secret hat and all that other stuff.
The article was actually in the Washington Post. And,
oh, okay.
He brought the hat out of his briefcase and was talking about his secret missions. one of the people that really had some input into the efforts to expose John Carey in 2004 is a man named B.G. Burkett, who wrote a book called Stolen Valor. And in that book, he did a tremendous job exposing the fact that huge numbers of supposed Vietnam veterans are actually fakes, including most of the people on the street that are homeless pretending to be Vietnam veterans. He actually challenged an editor of a major paper in Dallas to find him any real Vietnam veterans that were out begging on the street. And he, as fast as they brought him names, he shot them down by checking out their records. And eventually, I think they found one or two.
Let me ask you a question, Scott. The Carey story, or the Carey campaign, and I'm not referring to the political campaign, but the Carey campaign to instill himself and as a leader of something that of some sort of movement. How much of this was or is known to this day by the established Massachusetts political establishment? In other words, are they turning a blind eye? Because you don't see them. I've never seen Teddy Kennedy quite share the stage with him when he was on that, on the Vietnam thing.
Well, Teddy Kennedy was very much Carey's sponsor. Carey was a friend of the Kennedy family before he ever went to Vietnam. And so I think that, there are pictures of Kennedy and Carey walking around during the 1971 protests in Washington, D.C., obviously conferring. So I think that... at least in the case of Teddy Kennedy, he was very much part of the planning and promises and what have you that led to Carey becoming a political figure, which of course was Carey's ambition all along. There's a revealing moment in Carey's April 22nd, 1971 testimony before the Senate, where one of the senators says to Carey, what a magnificent job he's doing in coming forward, and that he hopes that he will see Carey as a member of this body, i.e. the Senate, before long. I think it was pretty clear that Carey's reward for all this was a political career.
So what you're saying is that they knew that Carey was fronting for the Vietnam veterans, and they knew that Carey was concocting these stories?
Well, I don't know to the former, certainly. I mean, he was there as the spokesman for the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who were conducting a week-long protest in D.C., so that was pretty clear. The extent to which mainstream politicians knew that the claims made at the Winter Soldier investigation were fictitious isn't really clear. And, in fact, it wasn't knowable for a while because the Army and Navy took several months to investigate them and eventually declined to file any charges, as we know from records now available at the National Archives.
So what does that mean now? In other words, we know that Carey did a dance. Are these politicians supporting him in the same way they did before? Are they pretending none of this ever happened, as politicians do so well? I mean, at some point, somebody's going to ask somebody, okay, we know that Carey did the dance. How do you feel about that?
Well, in fact, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that politicians on the left are attempting to turn the very word swift voting into a political curse by using it constantly as a pejorative. Hillary Clinton did this just the other day. You know, we will not allow our future to be swift voted. Well, that has interesting implications for free speech.
Yes, and one thing that you do in your website, you quote Glenn Reynolds, who said, "With swift voting now being used by the ignorant as a synonym for false charges, it is worth remembering that it was John Kerry who had to retract his statement about his secret Christmas mission to Cambodia." Despite it having allegedly been seared into his memory. And it seems to me we need more swift voting rather than less.
Yes, the swift veterans and the other anti-Kerry veterans were effective in 2004 because they were believed, not just because they leveled charges at Kerry. People level political charges all the time. And they were believed because they were credible, and they backed their statements with evidence and documents and affidavits. In the case, for example, of the first TV ad, which got a tremendous, made a huge impact, every single man who appeared in that ad signed a legal affidavit backing his statement, and they delivered to TV station managers a package that was in excess of 60 pages to document these charges. And the standards are very high for political advertising. And if the ad had been rejected or if the ad had been taken off the air, that would have been a huge blow to the Swift vets. And they and their legal counsels were aware of that fact.
So how do you get around the he said, she said aspect of all this?
Well,
Kerry had his own vets come up and back him up.
Well, they did to an extent, and that's very interesting. The so-called Band of Brothers that appeared with Kerry on stage at the Democratic National Convention and elsewhere backed him to a point, but when it came to items like, well, was he ever actually in Cambodia, as he repeatedly claimed, they got real quiet. There apparently were limits to how far they would go to support what Kerry had to say.
So I was unaware of that.
And furthermore, late in the campaign, these guys quit going on the air, which is also very interesting because at that time, of course, the Swift Vet radio and TV presence was increasing in all over the country. On the occasions where the Band of Brothers members did go head-to-head against Swift Vets, they came off rather poorly.
Is John Kerry now carrying the Swift Boats veterans? Is that an anchor around his leg now at this point? I mean, is his political career effectively over?
I don't know that his political career is effectively over. I don't think that there's much chance he will ever be the presidential nominee again because it's obvious to the big money people for the Democrats that there's a large segment of the military veteran population that is going to rise up on their hind legs and make lots of noise if that occurs.
Right. It fascinates. To me, it's absolutely fascinating how good a job Kerry and his supporters did in presenting this, this whole anti-war campaign, so to speak. You're talking about Kerry is effectively, a phosphate-swilling pimp, with a maladaptive tendency.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This is a guy who morphs into whatever he's given to drink.
Sure, he's an opportunist.
Yeah, right. So it just fascinates me as to how willing he was to fall into this.
Well, the consistent theme through Kerry's career is that he's going towards power and personal aggrandizement like a heat-seeking missile.
Right.
When being opposed to the Vietnam War is enormously popular, he's a leader of the anti-war movement. When in 2004, with the military, the most respected American institution, now he's a Vietnam War hero. So I think that's adequate to explain Kerry. However, the other point you touch on is, you know, how effective this disinformation campaign was. And there I think we have to look beyond the actual perpetrators to the media, which acted as an uncritical amplifier and mouthpiece and presented all these horrendous charges as though they were not only true but had been proven true.
Right.
One thing that was interesting in the book is how far so many people were going to deny that there was any cooperation between the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the Communist Party too. I mean, there was even they were even denying in parts of it that Ho Chi Minh was a communist, and there was some denial that there was any connection between the death toll in Southeast Asia being caused by communists. I thought that was amazing.
Well, that's pretty standard leftist disinformation, and it is striking that the Holocaust, which followed the American abandonment of South Vietnam, really hasn't been publicized in the American mainstream media, so much so that people like Ted Kennedy can stand up and sneer about projections that an Iraqi civil war might have similar, you know, devastating results by saying, yeah, I remember when people said if we pulled out of Vietnam, there'd be a bloodbath. Well, of course, there was a bloodbath, but he is confident that most people don't know that.
The calling number is
652-2639,
and we welcome your calls.
I had another point to make here, if I could, and that is if you read any of the writings by General Giap, I think I'm pronouncing it right, the North Vietnamese leader, who stated, and I quote, that it was our own news media that lost the war in Vietnam. If we had continued our aggressive way we were handling the war there, we would have won.
Well, you have to be careful with quotes or purported quotes from General Giap, because there are a number of those floating around online that I have never been able to find sources for. Nevertheless, the larger point is accurate, which is that the Vietnamese communists and their masters, the Soviets, relied very heavily on the disinformation war in the U.S. and the anti-war movement to win politically what they couldn't win militarily. It was what they referred to as a left-hand, right-hand strategy, and in the event, it was effective.
I was going to ask you, guest, could you speak up a bit because you're a little hard to hear.
All right, I'll try and get right in the phone. Is that better?
That's better. Thank you.
Okay.
What kind of connections are there now, if any, between the communists? I hate to use that word because it's almost passé.
Well, and they did a good job making it passé.
Yeah, they did a great job. That's exactly right.
You call somebody a fascist and it carries a sting.
Right. But does Kerry still have these kind of connections? Or has he become more nuanced, more sophisticated?
Yes, I think is the answer. He still maintains connections to a lot of the hardcore leftists
For example, who?
Joe Bangert stood up on stage with him during his, I think after his victory in New Hampshire. And this is a guy who prides himself on having sung the national anthem of North Vietnam at multiple occasions, and basically was a cheerleader for the Vietnamese communists for decades. And he had a group of veterans around him, which he called the Dog Hunters. And in all of his campaigns previous to 2004, they acted as sort of political shock troops. And anyone who challenged or attempted to challenge any of his statements, they would attack them and say, well, we were in Vietnam and you weren't. Well, that didn't work nearly as well against the Swift Vets.
Right.
We have a question on the chat room. Maybe Deb is asking, maybe Scott can tell us, who is funding the Iraq veterans against the war, if you know?
Well, we know they're doing fundraising in the usual, rich leftist circles. That they're going to people who have bankrolled similar efforts before. I don't have specifics on that, and I don't.
Is Code Pink a part of that?
I don't know that Code Pink is directly related to. You may not be aware, the Iraq Veterans Against the War has scheduled a second winter soldier hearing for mid-March in Washington, D.C., at which they hope to apparently recapture their success in smearing American troops as war criminals from 1971.
Right, but the truth is the Iraq veterans are nowhere near as successful as the Vietnam veterans are. I mean, the Iraq Veterans Against the War do elicit a lot of eye-rolling, you know, especially when they bring up that same titled rhetoric and the same accusations. I mean, no one takes them quite as seriously than the choir they're preaching to.
I'm going to have to dispute that in one sense. They're taken very seriously overseas. And one of the leaders of the IVAW is a man named Jimmy Massey, who came back and alleged genocide and this atrocity and that, former Marine. And his claims were fairly quickly debunked here, and even though he'd had complimentary articles in the Associated Press and elsewhere, the mainstream American media dropped him like a hot rock. But his claims continue to echo overseas and do harm to American interests, which is, of course, why they were made.
Right, but that's to be expected. There's a whole cadre of pseudo-journalists and pseudo-pundits who make their living getting stuff published overseas. I mean, they couldn't get stuff published here, in a local, auto trader. But overall, I mean, the Iraq Veterans Against the War really just don't have legitimacy.
And there's a couple reasons for that. One is the entire consciousness-raising exercise of the 2004 campaign, which refocused attention on whether the original claims were true and provided a lot of evidence that they weren't, that it was propaganda. And another is that we're now in an era of much faster communication and fact-checking. When these guys come forward and tell stories, there are going to be people talking to their former companies and battalions and trying to find out what, if anything, of their claims are true. So I think that already we're seeing some backing off on the part of the IVAW on the claim that war crimes are widespread. I don't think they're going to be able to sustain that.
No, I don't think they're going to be able to sustain it. In the same way, I mean, I'm sure you recall, I think it was Human Rights Watch who was asking, or Amnesty was asking anybody to come forward that could verify that Guantanamo was indeed like Auschwitz.
Right.
This preposterous notion, and they were literally begging, well, we can't find anybody, but could somebody please, we'll take your testimony, that kind of thing.
Right, operators are standing by.
The operators are standing by. Right. Clearly they're a more marginal group.
They're more marginal if they're marginalized, and that's obviously a big piece of what those of us who support the military are trying to do, because their claim should be marginal. If someone comes forward and alleges criminal activity, the onus should be on them to provide hard evidence and back it up. If it's true, then by all means, these things should be prosecuted.
See, it seems to me, and I think this is where you guys do a really good job. It seems to me that there is no groundswell of support, not really, for the anti-war. I mean, we seem to believe that there's this huge, that the country is divided about the war simply because Congress is divided about the war. We seem to believe that the country is divided about the war because there are numerous demonstrations against the war. But what no one's talking about, nobody shows up at these demonstrations. I mean, this isn't a Vietnam era thing, and I mean, even in Berkeley, I mean, for God's sakes, in Berkeley, I mean, they're backing down,
And in Berkeley, there are more people opposing the Berkeleyites than defending them, which I think is interesting.
Right. I mean,
even in Berkeley.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. So I mean, I think they may have shot their wad.
Well, from my point of view, that doesn't mean that the battle doesn't need to be fought. It merely means
Agreed.
That we're having some success.
Right. I mean, it is interesting to note that you know, after Vietnam, and after a liberal media, you know, 30 years of a liberal media, 30 years after Vietnam, the media still and a liberal media still cannot inflict their agenda on America.
Well, they did for many years.
For a long time.
They did instill the idea of Vietnam veterans as you know, damaged goods, you know, people unable to function in society, you know, people that were you know, scarred and horrified by what they'd done and so forth.
Yeah, but in a way they were too successful, because there's now a whole thing, you know, well, maybe we treated these people badly.
Yeah,
maybe they weren't so bad. Maybe this, you know, wasn't exactly, you know, the way it was made out to be. So they, in effect, did their job too well.
Well, as it happened, and they created the circumstances, they created the opportunity for the kind of backlash we saw in 2004, which I would argue was the reason that John Kerry is not president right now.
We have another caller from, let's see if I can get it to work. From area code 464. Hello, caller.
Hello, this is Paul calling from Sweden. This is Andrew Require.
Hi, Paul.
I wanted to ask Scott, what can actually be verified and can be documented about Kerry's medals? There's a lot of talk out there. I've heard some things that he filled out one of his applications himself after it was rejected by his commanding officer. And what's his actual medal story?
Well, the Swift Boat veterans went back and looked at all those incidents and tried to find as many people as they could who were eyewitnesses. And in the case, for example, of his first Purple Heart, they spoke to his commander, a man named Grant Hibbard. And Hibbard said, "I never signed off on it. I don't know how I got it." And they also spoke to the doctor who had treated him for what appeared to be an accidentally self-inflicted wound by shooting a grenade launcher short. Well, you have to be wounded by the enemy to have it actually qualify as Purple Heart. So that was one of the arguments they made. And the doctor said, "Yeah, it was just a sliver. I took it out with a pair of tweezers and put a Band-Aid on it." No one has been able to find the paperwork for that medal or how he obtained it. So they, you know, that was just one of the arguments they laid out on the table. They suggested that his account of the event where he got the Bronze Star and also his third Purple Heart, that was his so-called No Man Left Behind engagement, where one of the boats was returning, five boats were returning from a mission, one of them hits a mine and blows up, and what Kerry said in his advertising, millions of dollars of advertising, and at the Democratic National Convention, was that he and his boat heroically turned back into a withering ambush to rescue a special forces officer who'd fallen in the river. But what emerged from the detailed investigation done by the Swift vets, and this part of it was actually confirmed by an independent investigation by the Washington Post, was that Kerry's boat was the only one to leave the scene of the mining, that he took off downriver while everybody else was trying to do rescue operations. And the majority of people that were there, and we go into this in the book in some detail. We actually have taken this story farther now than was possible in 2004, that the only aspect of the ambush was a mine explosion, that there was no incoming gunfire. We were able to track down a FAC pilot who watched the action from overhead, and also the Special Forces officer, Jim Rassman's commanding officer, who also said that there was no enemy fire, as Kerry had stated. Now, the way that Kerry accomplished a lot of this stuff, according to the Swift vets, was by the very simple expedient of filing false after-action reports. And nobody else knew he was doing that. So until they went back and investigated the record and compared what was in the reports to, you know, what they had actually witnessed, it wasn't clear to anybody you know, what he had done and the extent to which he'd falsified the record.
Why would he falsify the record?
Because to make himself...
No, I'm not saying that he didn't, but I'm just saying what do you attribute to what do you attribute his motivation for this? I mean, clearly, I mean, he would have thought at some point these things would be looked at again.
He was acquiring medals, so he could go home and agitate against the war with authority.
Be a hero.
And are these records available that contradict his accounts?
There are additional records that contradict his accounts, but there are a number of eyewitness people that were members of the Swift boats that fought in the Mekong Delta, knew Carey, went out on missions with him. Those are the people that made up the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And when they got together and said, okay, you know, you were at this event, I was at this event, let's compare notes and write down what happened. The accounts that came out of that showed that Carey's after-action reports had very little basis in reality. Now, of course, the media took this and said, well, Carey says this, the Swift Boat guys say that, but the official Navy records back Carey, without mentioning that Carey actually wrote the records they were talking about.
Yeah, I have one last question. That's with all of Carey's Purple Hearts, how much time did he spend disabled in the hospital?
No, he never went to the hospital.
Is it very uncommon for someone to receive so many Purple Hearts and never actually be out of commission?
Yes, but it's not that minor wounds don't merit Purple Hearts. It's just that most of the guys that were in those situations, especially if they managed to spray themselves with a shrapnel from a grenade launcher, just went about their business. They weren't there to get, you know, Purple Hearts or medals. And Carey was actually in the field about 4 months, and to get 3 Purple Hearts and not spend a day in the hospital, it would certainly be unusual.
Okay, I'm going to drop. Thank you very much, Scott. It's very good to listen to you today.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for calling, Paul. Anybody else who would like to call, the phone number is 646-652-2639. We're talking to John Sweat, author of To Set the Record Straight,
Scott.
How Swift Boat Veterans, POWs, and the New Media Defeated John Carey. By the way, I went through, the book has 40 pages of references, notes, and documentation. And I did check a fair amount of them because I am a thorough person. And truly, it is very well documented. This is not based on hearsay. This is not just a few guys signing a paper saying, well, you know, this is what I think. These are interviews, things that were shown on TV, documentation from federal statistics and inquiries into war crimes, and a great deal of information, Federal Bureau of Investigation files on Vietnam veterans against the war, NBC Evening News of the time, and so on. The documentation is very substantial, which is also a very good thing because of this particular trend that we're seeing on this campaign, saying where they're trying to redefine swift boating as being an unfair or false criticism.
Well, the tactic that the Carey campaign used against the Swift Boat Veterans when they first came out was to allege falsely that this was a Republican operation, that this was, you know, Karl Rove, you know, pulling the strings, and that all these veterans were just helpless puppets being used by Republicans, or that they themselves were Republican operatives. And what actually happened, of course, was that this was a series of individual initiatives by people like Admiral Roy Hoffman, who was the man who commanded the entire Swift boat operation in the Mekong Delta. And how the Swift vets came about, as we describe in the book, is that Admiral Hoffman read the biography of Carey, Tour of Duty, by the historian Douglas Brinkley, and it didn't square at all with his own experiences. So he climbed up into his attic and found a bunch of boxes with listings of his old command. And he and his wife very methodically started trying to track these guys down after 35 years and call them up. And when he got somebody on the phone, he would say, you know, this is Admiral Hoffman. I'd like to ask you to read this book and at least check the aspects, you know, anything that you were personally involved with. Please, you know, report back to me and let me know whether it's true or if not, you know, what the truth is. And that was the genesis of the Swift Boat Veterans, that after just a few weeks, they had all these accounts and 80 or 90 guys that were completely refuting Kerry's biography as stated in public.
See, what I also found interesting was the, do you recall, you know, they threw their medals away and all, you know, there was a big production about throwing their medals away, you know, returning their medals and so on and so forth. And, of course, that turned out to be just utter poppycock.
Well,
can you recount that story?
Yeah, that's the day after Kerry spoke in the spring of 1971 in Washington before the Senate. The next day, as part of that week-long demonstration, which led up to a much larger national demonstration by the entire anti-war movement in Washington, they had these guys very theatrically walk up and throw away their medals and ribbons over a temporary fence that surrounded the Capitol, and Kerry was one of those. That's actually one of the first stories that we broke in the website I created, wintersoldier.com, was that Kerry spokesman Michael Meehan was characterizing the VVAW as moderate and thoughtful people who just wanted to end the war. He's trying to, you know, defuse criticism that these were crazed radicals. Well, I was able to find a Quaker group that still had a video of that event and purchased a copy and slapped it up on wintersoldier.com. What you see are these guys walking up and throwing handfuls of medals away and then screaming threats against the U.S. government. And the end of the, you know, threats of revolution, you know, one guy is saying, you know, we don't want to fight again, but if we do, it'll be to take these steps. And he's pointing at the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Well, that kind of shot down the moderate and thoughtful theory for anybody that saw the video. And the end of that film clip, which had been produced by the VVAW, was a blast of automatic weapons fire.
Did they really throw their medals away, or was this just all hokey?
Well, they threw medals away. Whether they were their medals away is dubious. One of the members of the VVAW who later recanted his testimony, a man named Steve Pitkin, said that he saw guys standing around with bags full of medals and decorations, and guys were just reaching in and getting handfuls. And he said he further heard rumors that the VVAW had cleaned out the local Army-Navy stores the day before. Pitkin further said that some of the medals that they threw away were wrong for Vietnam, that they were, you know, like Korean War medals and stuff. So, you know, the VVAW was all about what they call guerrilla theater, which, you know, was doing shocking things in public to get the media. They staged murders of civilian on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, or guys, you know, with toy guns. Of course, this stage had carted away now. You know, pretended to shoot down civilians who broke, you know, bags of blood on the steps. You know, and this was taken very seriously by the news media of the time, instead of, you know, the cheap theatrics that it really was.
But I think, as I said before, you know what, I think we're all a little more sophisticated now.
Well, I hope you're right, and you know, there's evidence that that's the case. One great advantage that we have is instantaneous communication, because most people, the reason the VVAW was successful in 1971 is because the three main networks of the day were utterly sympathetic and supportive and gave Kerry and his guys almost endless airtime during that week, and, you know, catapulted Kerry into the status of you know, national hero for the anti-war movement. It's difficult to imagine that happening today, say for a you know, Jimmy Massey.
Are the days of the Kerry-like efforts, the Vietnam veteran efforts, are those days numbered?
Well, I think we're deciding that right now, because the anti-war left has decided to roll the dice. The five-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq is coming up, and the anti-war movement had plans for large demonstrations at that time. But they have mostly stood aside in favor of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, which they seem to feel will give them their best shot at reaching the hearts and minds of the people. So I think we'll know in just a couple of months what sort of political impact that they're able to have by telling their horror stories.
What are your gut telling you?
I think they're going to be surprised at the response. I think that I think the basic understanding that unsourced, unsupported claims of atrocities carry no weight is much more widely understood than it was a few years ago.
One thing that Deb in the chat room has just mentioned is that the huge difference between the success rates of the Vietnam veterans against the war and the Iraq veterans against the war is that the draft has ended, and that the Vietnam anti-war movement lost a lot of steam after the draft ceased. And having an all-volunteer army, I agree, I definitely agree with her. I was wondering what your view was on this.
Well, that's certainly a good point. A lot of the steam came out of the Vietnam-era anti-war movement when the draft was ended, but the Vietnam veterans against the war, their you know, greatest successes came after that point in 1971.
See, there's something else I think. You know, I'm contemplating as you're speaking. We don't see today, you know, the Vietnam era anti-war protesters. A lot of them were a pretty smart lot. You know, you had some pretty intelligent people involved in that effort, and you don't see that today. Today, you're basically looking at a bunch of misfits and, you know, failure to launch type of people.
Well, you always had that split during the Vietnam War. The failure to launch types were the the street cannon fodder. One of the reasons that the anti-war movement was as effective as it was that it had the ability to put 500,000 people on the doorstep of the government.
Right.
And that can be very intimidating, and that might explain why people like Jane Fonda never went to jail. They don't seem to have that now. As to, you know, the relative intelligence of the people who are actually pulling the strings, it's hard to say. Most of them are deliberately anonymous.
Yeah, and they also seem to be just, I mean, there's nothing fresh here. There's nothing new here. I mean, even critics, you know, who are revered by the anti-war people like Juan Cole, I mean, they're just rehashing and rehashing and rehashing. There's no original thinking.
No, well, they're attempting to reinforce success. It worked last time. Perhaps it can work this time.
Right. I mean, to their credit, I mean, the Vietnam veterans, the Vietnam era war protesters, there were some pretty sharp people out there.
Well, that's true. A number of the people like Dave Dellinger and Tom Hayden, you know, these were very effective political activists.
Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, I mean, you know, they're pretty sharp guys.
Yeah, less so there, perhaps.
Right. No, of course, I'm not comparing Abby Hoffman to Tom Hayden. But they were pretty sharp guys on their own. And you don't see that today.
I think that's because most of the talent of the left has now gone into, you know, government or industry. You know,
or academics.
In the system rather than outside throwing rocks inside.
Right.
One question from Rob in chat. How do you deal with the ideal, quote, I support the troops but not the war?
That's a nice slogan. We see, for example, in Berkeley, that's not really the case. They're not supporting the Marines. They consider them contemptible and want them out of town.
Well, there's that great photograph, I support the troops who shoot their senior officers or commanding officers.
Oh.
And, yeah. But now, if that had happened in 1971, you'd never have had the opportunity to see it because the networks would not have carried it. That image, the blue banner, became popular because it blasted across the Internet.
Right.
And so that's a huge difference there. You know, for example, the banner that sank Kerry's 2008 campaign, you know, help us, John Kerry, we are stuck here in Iraq.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
How many people, how important were the events of 9/11 in shaping or in weakening the anti-war movement, in shaping the opinions of people who just won't get on board the anti-war movement?
I think that it slowed down their timetable. I think that the shock of 9/11 caused the anti-war movement to lay low for a year or two until those events were forgotten by most people, at which point they put their you know, predictable plans into effect.
Right. I just have a feeling. I think, you know, Americans are pretty smart, notwithstanding what the cultural elites on either coast tend to say. And I really believe that most Americans understand that 9/11 was a pivotal event.
If I may, and I don't mean this to interrupt you, Ziggy, but I've always had a thought that a lot of this started, I kind of more or less put this hypothesis together myself, what the ACLU started with, you know, the communist movement or the Communist Party movement, and these Code Pink and about all these, whether it was the Vietnam War or the current war, have come about from these communist parties.
Well, regardless of whether these are, you know, communist-dominated activities, I think we can say that the consistent theme that runs through the actions of the left is that the U.S. is the bad guys, and that the U.S. military, which of course is the arm of the United States, which allows us to enforce our will, is therefore doubly bad guys. To get back to your point about 9/11, I'm not sure that at this remove, almost 7 years later, that it has much impact on American thinking. You know, if we'd been hit again once or twice, then I think that would crystallize the threat in most people's minds. But it's very easy to think of 9/11 as a one-off, never to be repeated event until, of course, it happens again.
I think this is where we're diverting. I really do think 9/11 had an impact on people. And I think that certainly the left, a lot of the media have been desperately trying, you know, well, it was our own fault, and, you know, somehow that if we saw more clearly the threats of 9/11 would go away, the threats post 9/11 would go away. But I think people just aren't buying it.
Well, the thesis of the left is that that we were attacked because we acted in ways that were unacceptable, and we need to understand why people don't like us and change the way that we are to so that we won't be disliked. And as you suggest, that's a very tough sell in Peoria. That's not something that the left doesn't really have a plausible story for 9/11 that makes us the bad guys.
Right. I mean, you really can't. I love when they talk about root causes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a root cause, but the truth is people don't fly planes into buildings because of poverty. And you don't fly a plane into a building because you're complaining about the gross national product of Saudi Arabia or Syria or Lebanon versus that of America or Israel.
And, of course, the hijackers were not impoverished.
That's right. They were middle class.
Right.
And educated, too.
And educated, too. But I think that somehow this whole notion that there's a root cause... have you ever noticed that there's always a root cause when something goes wrong? Right? There's no root cause when something goes right.
Well, I think it's like election fraud. You know, if it's observable that there's great concern about election fraud when Republicans win elections and virtually none when Democrats do.
Right. Which is funny I know it's a little off topic, but really the vast majority of verifiable election fraud has been by the left side.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
I haven't done
a lot of study of that.
Yeah, it's quite a... I mean, it is an interesting study. And I have to say, there was one blogger, Kate McMillan of Small Dead Animals, who after the 2006 midterm elections had this marvelous post. You know, because there were all these saying, well, they're getting ready to cheat and there's the frauders in place. And
right.
She had this marvelous post. I think it was just a few words. And she wrote, well, I guess the Republicans threw the election.
Or similarly, during
right.
the Clinton years from 92 to 2000, homelessness in America vanished.
Right.
You know, you couldn't find a homeless person on the TV news for 8 years, and then suddenly, poof, you know, they reappeared.
Right, 3 weeks later, there were tens of thousands.
Yeah, one wonders where they were hiding.
Absolutely. there's another question I wanted to ask you also. When the Vietnam veterans came back, and I think that this, by the way, what I'm going to, I want to preface by saying I think that the left made a huge mistake, because when the Vietnam veterans came back to America, they were, you know, baby killers. They were victims of tremendous contempt, and my God, you know, anybody that had ever worn a uniform, you know, was to hang their head in shame and so on and so forth. And there's a more determined effort today, and we touched on it earlier, there's a more determined effort today not to do that.
I think that's true. I saw some of that firsthand. My dad is a Vietnam veteran, and mm-hmm. He came home, and when he was working at Andrews Air Force Base, his commanding officer more than suggested, instructed him not to wear his uniform in public. He said it wasn't safe. It was likely to incite attacks and so forth. You know, and that's not the that's not the proper regard that the members of the U.S. military should be held in by the public.
Well, even notwithstanding that, just from a strictly strategic political point of view, I mean, when Code Pink and Berkeley and elsewhere, we have a right to beat up the guys and the troops and the returning vets and all that. Americans respond at this point, and I think in no small measure because of 9/11, there's a knee-jerk response of revulsion at that.
I think so, but I think it's been a slower process than that. I think that even before 9/11, you could find polls that suggested that the military was very highly respected compared to a couple of decades before. I'm not sure quite what to ascribe that to, but I think perhaps just gradually growing resistance to the propaganda would explain it as well as anything.
How much of it has to do with people actually being related to and working with and knowing closely many Vietnam veterans? Because I have worked with some very excellent gentlemen who were Vietnam veterans, and we're talking about a large number of men who went to Vietnam. How much does it have to do with, saying, hey, Joe is a regular guy.
That's a real good point.
Pete's a great guy. You know, these are men who have led excellent lives. They're good fathers. They're good workers. They behave normally. I mean, nobody's doing a deer hunter on anybody. How much does it have to do with that, too?
I think that may be as good of an explanation as any. There were 2.6 Vietnam veterans, men and women who fought in Vietnam, and the way they have lived out their lives, of course, is in stark contrast to the poisonous image that was put forward in the media and in Hollywood. And I think that certainly over time has had a very positive effect on how they're seen. Another example of that was when the Swift Boat veterans came forward. You know, here are these guys on TV, and they're obviously not deranged. They're obviously very credible. Most of them are extremely successful. Guys like John O'Neill started his own law company and finished first in his law school class. Bill Franke had founded a large company and was running it. You know, these guys were not dysfunctional, and they were certainly not failures.
What do you make of the efforts now by organizations like the New York Times to paint Iraq vets as sort of the loose cannon, the same thing they did to the Vietnam vets?
Oh yeah, suicidal and committing crimes, that
kind of thing. Yeah,
they listed every violent crime by a returning veteran they could find, but failed to provide their readers with the statistics that showed that civilians in the same age group commit violent crimes at a much higher rate. That's pure disinformation, and that's who they are, and that's what they do.
Right. I think it's also interesting that I think people sort of at this stage tend to yawn. You know, there was a time or something like that. People wouldn't let it go.
Well, I'm sure the true believers that read the New York Times and believe everything that's in it will take this to heart. Oh my God, we have these dangerous veterans out there. But those that have other information sources, like say you read Powerline, are able to see that this is not an accurate portrayal of reality. And once you see that, then you never can't see it after that. It's always obvious to you.
Right.
Well, excellent. The book is To Set the Record Straight, How Swift Boat Veterans, POWs, and the New Media Defeated John Kerry. We have author Scott Sweat with us this morning, and we only have 1 minute left, so I want to thank Scott and Siggy and Phil and Peter from Sweden. Paul from Sweden, who called in, and I want to thank everybody in the chat room. Let me see, we got Lady Logician, Rob, X Demi, Flat Gazer, Wild Phil, The Ozone, Entry Required, and Political Vindication for joining us. Next Tuesday, we got a new podcast at 11 in the morning, so I hope you all join us then again. Thank you, Phil, Siggy, and especially Scott.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was a very enjoyable discussion.
Nice talking, Scott.
Thank you.
Right. Bye-bye.